You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. Welcome back, everybody. Been a busy summer for everybody. And I know last time, our last show, we talked about some of the recent facility closures and decommissions and some other things that are going on. So I guess we'll kind of pick up the ball, right?
Yeah. So there's been, and I thought, you know, like, it seems like everything keeps coming hot off the presses and it's hard to get through stuff, which is, you know, kind of cool. Stuff's happening. I actually expected another dump of policies. It seemed like mid-month, third week of the month, we were getting a bunch of new policies we haven't. Gives us a little bit of a breather for a catch-up. So that's kind of cool. Thought I'd talk about just a couple of them, couple things that, you know, folks need to be thinking about if they're heading to prison, if they've recently got there, their loved ones should know about. So just a couple of things. So for example, the literacy program policy statement. So high school diploma, high school equivalency, GED, the Bureau actually changed their time frame for verifying an individual's high school education from 60 days down to 28 days. So education departments will have 28 days to get a verification that an individual has completed either their high school diploma or received a GED, or they're going to be expected to be enrolled in locally GED program. And, you know, you and I talk about PSRs in the high school diploma, but the policy specifically, and this isn't new, but we're just kind of pointing it out, government personnel officially verify the high school diploma or its equivalent in the pre-sentence investigation report. The PSI should only be accepted as verification when the writer clearly indicates education records were verified. Bruce and I talk about this a lot when we do, when we have pre-arrival or pre-trial cases, pre-sentence cases, and we're looking at draft PSRs, that education information needs to be clearly stated. As I like to say, in individual reports, a family confirms, but officials verify. And that's what we're talking about. Just because you told the probation officer that you completed your, you know, you got your diploma at Big Town High School in Montana, and your mom tells, when they interview your mom says, yep, that's when you got his high school diploma. That is not verification. Why is that important? That verified high school diploma impacts custody classification, impacts pattern risk assessment, impacts whether or not you're put into a GED class, if you don't, whether you think you need it or not. And if you don't, now you're in opt-out status, which means you're not getting time credits. But wait a minute, there's one more. An individual who does not have their high school diploma and needs to participate and doesn't complete that requisite number of hours, and this is different than FSA, will actually earn less good conduct time. Instead of the 54 days a year, they drop to 42 days. And that doesn't magically get recalculated if 3 months down the road, you decide you're going to be cooperative and get your high school diploma. Like, you just had those, you lost those days, okay? So if you have your high school diploma or your GED, and you're facing incarceration, that needs to be verified in the probation report. And if the probation couldn't get your school to respond, I kind of say, this is your life. Take control of your life. Provide that transcript, provide that documentation. So just a little update, but the big change is dropping down to 28 days, which really just kind of puts it in alignment with the other assessments. Of course, education is one of the SPARK 13 needs assessment that ties into FSA. So it's really just aligning that. Another, I thought interesting was the inmate recreation program. So one of the things, and you know, Bruce, you've been at different facilities and so have I, and recreation staff sometimes get like the short end of it. Like, oh, they're just out there running around on the rec field. But recreation programs are truly important programs. And if we step back from just the prison management aspect of having people, you know, playing ball on the rec yard or in the hobby craft area or any of those kind of things, when it comes to criminogenic needs, when it comes to those things, recreation and leisure is actually a criminogenic need. And the Bureau doesn't capture that well. And I hope to see changes in the future. And I'm hopeful that this change in this policy statement is a reflection of that. So in the Bureau, rec, leisure, fitness is kind of clumped together under the Spark 13 needs assessment. And the Bureau's current assessment model focuses on that fitness element, right? So they're looking at individuals that have chronic care clinic assignments through medical, whether it's for obesity or high blood pressure or high cholesterol or diabetes and those kind of things, and things that wellness activities, exercise, good nutrition, those are things that can help mitigate some of those issues, right? Obviously, right? So we all hear that about eating healthy and exercise and all that good stuff, right? But from a criminogenic standpoint, it's not the fitness element that's important. It's that pro-social use of free time. Bruce, I was in Scouts growing up, did some sports, was active in church. You know, my parents' philosophy was, if I'm busy, I can't get in trouble. That kind of old adage, idle hands are the devil's workshop. Pro-social use of free time is one of those things that law-abiding citizens generally do. They have free time. They have hobbies. They do sports. They do community theater. They go to the theater. They use their free time in a positive pro-social way, as opposed to gambling on a street corner, throwing rocks off bridges at cars, and any number of antisocial uses of free time. So when you're talking about recreation in a prison environment, that right there is so important. So I was very excited to see this program statement. And if you look at it, they really get into a variety of issues, looking at individuals who are at risk. They talk about looking at recreation programs and referring individuals, talking about being overweight, negative health history, negative attitudes toward fitness and exercise, have cognitive, physical, emotional disability or needs, and or other physical or psychological problems. Working out is good for dealing with depression and other things. Obviously, there's for major depressive disorders, we have medication involved. But again, that good mental, physical health and wellness. But when you go through and you kind of look through the policy, and I would encourage folks to kind of go ahead and download it. I was very impressed. Recreation activities will be offered for indoor and outdoor recreation, at least 10 hours per day, to include morning, afternoon, and evening hours. Weekend hours must be provided to ensure access for individuals with morning, day, or evening work assignments. So again, they're putting in writing, you know, how much rec, when it's going to be indoor and outdoor. What are the goals of having a recreation program? Talking about something kind of fun. I don't know if I know we had an issue that happened at my last institution where a unit manager ordered new TVs for the housing unit and they were too big, right? Mm-hmm. Remember, we were all under the had to be only so many by so many. Well, they've updated that. So education, television, leisure stations, televisions no larger than 32 inches. I know that's still kind of small, but televisions for small television rooms, televisions must be no larger than 55 inches. That is a huge change. I can remember like 24 inches or some something. And of course we had him,
right.
I was at a penitentiary and we had him, you know, mounted to the columns. And so, you know, you can mount something to a column 20 feet in the air and it's only this. Yeah. So that was kind of just kind of getting updated with the times and the size of TVs. But they were talking about, you know, they've added an FSA component about recreation offering programs designed to address FSA needs. And currently, again, they're still focused on that fitness element, but I really hope to see some kind of evolution in that, doing a true rec leisure assessment. Not saying fitness isn't important, but when you're using the chronic care clinics to assess fitness, you're really kind of overlapping with the medical assessment, which of course medical isn't a criminogenic need. It's a responsivity factor. And if you haven't gotten our book yet, we've got a whole chapter and we explain R&R model and what those differences are. But again, they've kind of addressed education, or I should say wellness and health education programs in terms of different components, structured exercise, health awareness areas, at-risk program, wellness classes, volunteer and community resources, leisure programs and special events. So again, good stuff is in there. I am hoping this is a foreshadow of really, really looking at the value of recreation within the FSA model. Every recreation department in the country runs leagues, whether it's softball leagues or flag football leagues or volleyball leagues. They run tournaments over holiday weekends. Those are all good programs. You know, holidays are tough in a prison. And what recreation does to try to make the holidays a little less bad for individuals away from their family is just so important. But then, like I said, all the team activities, the team sports, again, just really, really good stuff. And what they do is so in line with FSA and the risk need model. So I'm hoping for good stuff there. What else do we have? So we talked about that. Okay. So one of the, another big change, they did a bunch of updates to the release preparation program. Again, some good stuff, because I was kind of involved in some conversations right before I retired when we were talking about the release preparation program and really the overlap with FSA programming and looking at those six core areas, which are still the same. They haven't changed. But looking at those six core areas and looking at where they overlap, and to send an individual for a 1-hour class to check a box on whatever employment related when they're taking an apprenticeship program, or they've been participating in mock job fair, or they've been taking these series of classes, but oh, we've got to have this box checked because this is RPP 3, is kind of silly. It's kind of redundant. You know me, I'm like all about efficiency and effectiveness. And so I was very excited to see this from just an administrative standpoint, because like I said, I was involved in several conversations that we talked about this. So now, of the six areas, let me see if I can, of the six areas, several of them can be accomplished just through routine FSA programming. Half of them can, or four of the six, I believe. But also, they've also gotten into, they've standardized the curriculum. So just like the parenting program is now a national curriculum, they have a national curriculum for the reentry program. They're also introducing, and some institutions have already started doing this, but they are now making it officially part of the release preparation program. Community resource days. These are opportunities where, and I will just pull it out here if I can find it very quickly. For inmates attending community resource days, determine specific resources that will meet their needs. Resources for persons unable to attend the actual resource days. They could arrange virtually. And one of the things I know we were doing with some of the East Coast facilities is either bringing in virtually or bringing in person was CSOSA, the Supervision Authority for the District of Columbia Superior Court cases. And that was something we did. We were trying to introduce more because they're not going out to supervision under federal probation. And almost every case management coordinator, reentry program manager in the country is bringing in their local probation officers to talk about supervised release. Well, what if you're not going to be on supervised release under probation? You want to ask your questions to the CSOSA people, and which is the court supervision folks out of DC. So yeah, so that's also another bringing in these, making community resource days not just a nice thing or optional. They're making it part of the program. And so I think that's also really good. They also talk about, and we've had some discussion on the Facebook group about the ID program. And of course, that is also spelled out, obtaining IDs. And I did, I posted a comment, I stand corrected. I had said it was Real ID compliant, and it is not Real ID compliant. But the Bureau has been working with the IDs. They've been working with TSA and other authorities because we are allowed to put, the Bureau is allowed to put individuals on
airplanes
with these IDs. But that's a program that's being coordinated through unit management and the Correctional Systems Department and the Reentry Office. One of the big changes with that was the change, and I think we talked about this on another show recently, is homelessness is not going to be a barrier. Back when they first rolled out the IDs, a person had to have an address. And of course, homelessness is the biggest barrier to getting identification. And if you can't get identification, then it becomes a barrier to housing, to jobs, to social services, and a variety of other things. So I was really glad to see that. And of course, they spelled out the process. Also important, if an individual has an ID, obviously they've got it. They don't need to worry about this. But we do see a lot of individuals that don't, and getting that taken care of is important. Not everybody is required to go through release preparation. You know, obviously, if you're serving a life sentence, if you're facing deportation, if you're a very short sentence, you know, you come in and you got a little 6-month sentence and you're going back out, they're not going to run you through the whole problem. You can be exempt from that. So those are, again, a lot of good information. They've kind of beefed it out quite a bit. There's still some things that I think could be improved, but again, much improvement. So those are good. Okay. So we're going to talk about a couple of things. Well, I'm going to hold off on that. We're trying to talk about the tablets. I know there's a big announcement, a lot of stuff. Want to talk about the tie-in with FSA and its importance, but I did want to talk about, see, I'm looking here. I feel like, remember the old Rush Limbaugh show at like 11:30 at night where he'd have like the stacks of papers and he was going through them? That's what I feel like I'm doing to make sure I haven't missed things. Because we have been adding to this stack for like, what, a month and a half now? Every time we come on, it's like more stuff to announce. Okay, so before we get to that, we're going to talk about this. So they did put out a lockdown and modified operation policy statement. This is the first time. A lot of this information, it's not necessarily new. What's new is that it's publicly available. Information on reporting and lockdowns and when you make these decisions and how these are done were always kind of contained in non-public policy, contingency plans, and other kind of things that the Bureau uses kind of behind the scenes. But I think it was important from a transparency standpoint that they put this out. You know, obviously there has been a lot of negative feedback, I would say. Things that happened, you know, due to staffing issues, we're seeing, you know, we see, well, they canceled visiting, or, oh, we're locked down because we don't have this, or whatever the case is. And of course, talking about the difference between a lockdown, which is a complete ceasing of operations, everything shuts down, versus modified operations. So they did, they issued this new policy, a lot of information in it. We're not going to go through everything because it is a lot. But they did, they defined some things. They defined what are the expectations, you know, getting mail, you know, the institutions, mailroom will deliver mail. Mail is going to get picked up every day, even if you're locked down. Access to legal services still has got to happen, even if you're locked down. Now it needs to be necessary, right? So if you're wanting to set up a legal call with your attorney, you're still required to demonstrate that you need a legal call. This is a time-sensitive matter. That hasn't changed. On the other hand, if a lawyer is coming in and needs to set up a legal visit because of some action that's going on, they can call in and set that up. And institution being locked down is not grounds to go, no, you can't come in and see your client on his appeal that's going on. Okay. So phone and email access gets limited, obviously, when individuals are secured in their cells. Sometimes, though, it might be a modified operation. Maybe individuals are just secured to the housing unit. They can still roam around freely in the housing unit. You're just, nobody's going out for recreation, or it's controlled movement, one unit at a time. That's not a lockdown. That is modified operations. So essential services are still going on. And they outline what are the essential services. And it's kind of a no-brainer. But again, I think in the interest of transparency, putting it out there is important. So mail delivery, access to legal, inmate and phone access, albeit it would be limited, access to medical and mental health care, food service operation, be it hot meals and satellite distribution and how they handle that. Laundry and hygiene, commissary access, showers, shower operations, sanitation, and required religious accommodations. So again, they're just kind of spelling out. They also go through what is a lockdown, what is modified operations, and then the third category is temporarily secured. Sometimes you're just securing an area until you can do whatever needs to be done, whether that's a search, whether that is an accountability check. Maybe we're doing, we secure an area and we're doing a census check, right? Because we got something unaccounted for, something we're concerned about. So then they go through just the different things. And again, full lockdowns, and they talk about the kinds of just things that should happen, that may happen that would require it. Major disturbances, escapes, suspected escapes, incidents of violence. And I think that's a reasonable thing. If there's an escape or an attempted escape from a secure facility, they're locking everything down. Like that's prison business. Critical infrastructure failure. We've had some instances where had a storm and have the external fence go down, you know, on a secure facility, the fence going down is a problem. Yeah. So, you know, again, might not necessarily like it, but when it comes to managing a prison, that's necessary. Extreme weather and natural disasters, contagious disease outbreaks. Can we all say COVID? There was quite some lessons learning on how the Bureau was going to manage like prison when you've got this rampant communicable disease going on. And the courts hadn't shut down right away, and the marshals hadn't stopped moving folks, and people's release dates didn't all of a sudden get suspended. People were still being released. All these things were happening, yet you have this infectious disease that requires you to physically separate people. We had hot and cold units. You know, the bus would come in and they'd all go to one unit, and you were quarantined as a group. And if nobody got sick, Woohoo! Now you're going in. Now you're going to go into population. But if someone got sick on the unit, if someone popped hot because for COVID, man, the whole unit was staying put. It was a necessary evil. From a prison management standpoint, a lot of good lessons were learned from COVID, not just in the Bureau, but across corrections. But anyway, I know finding a silver lining to COVID was probably a little bit of a challenge, but anyway, mass contraband searches. Anyone who's been in prison or worked in prison, you know, sometimes everything shuts down and we're searching for contraband, whether it's some dangerous contraband or we're just trying to take stuff off the yard. I can remember I had a warden that on the Friday, invariably it was Friday, sometimes Thursday, but usually Friday, end of the week before some big game was happening, whether it was some big college game or some big, you know, like NFL, NBA finals, these kind of things. Like we would lock down and we went housing unit, searching for hooch, searching for homebrew, trying to get as much of it. We know what's happening. We catch it as you're doing random searches. But man, every housing unit, every cell, looking for everything, because again, homebrew is bad. People like to drink and then fight because their team lost. So again, those are the kind of things that happen. Ongoing investigations. Again, that kind of when a disturbance, when something happens, when you get word something is going to happen, when you get intel that something's going down on the yard at 7 o'clock tonight, will the Bureau preemptively lock down a yard? 100%. The goal is not to have bodies on the yard, not to have people fighting and killing each other. I say that because I was at a penitentiary for 11 years.
That was like at Lee, right? That's when it would go down is after a meal, right? People would.
God, it was like
rock and roll.
It was like between 1 and 3 on a Friday, and it would be like. Like, why would you do that? Because now you've screwed up visiting. Like, if you're going to have a problem, you have a problem on like Monday. So then we can sort it all out. And maybe you have visiting on Friday. But there was a period where I swear every single melee on the yard, not melee, that's an exaggerate, large scale fight on the yard between different geographical groups of individuals, be they regional or gang affiliations, would get into a fight on the yard. And then we're like trying to sort people out. And it was a mess. I mean, administratively, it was a mess. But some of the stories, you know, it's a little bit of gallows humor. Last thing, broad publicity security events. Every once in a while, something's going on. Some high profile individual is getting released or a high profile individual is turning themselves in. And every media outlet in the world wants to be there to check it out. Well, that creates a security nightmare for the agency, especially when you consider a lot of institutions have satellite camps that don't have a fence. And then sometimes you get overeager reporters who want to like get a closer shot. So they're like sneaking up on the property, things like that. Not helpful at all. But the rest of the policy goes into kind of the notifications that are required, the rationalizations, when they're going to do what. If it comes down to, and so I had some questions in me reading it and thinking about, well, okay, what if you're short? Does visiting get sacrificed? Do you shut visiting down? Or does it make more sense to maybe for the hours of visiting, shut down indoor recreation, shut down some other areas, because shutting down those areas for the period of visitation so that we can have visiting continue, you know, the balance, like, do we want to lose some rec time or do we want to lose some visitation times? And I think that for families is a big issue, because a lot of times when that's happening, there's little to no notice when they've done this. And so they're driving hours, maybe they've flown in, only to find out that visitation's canceled. And visitation is canceled because we had this person call in sick, or that person was on leave, or whatever happened, and now we don't have enough coverage. So visitation is sacrificed, because for visiting, you'll have at least two officers. And if I've got vacant housing units, I need to put the officers in the housing units, so sacrifice visiting. I would like to see, they didn't go into it to that extent of when and how they would make those choices. But with the, again, with the requirements for notification, the reporting, they make reference to a report form, which is not publicly available. We've been monitoring that to see if that form becomes publicly available. But so it's there's good information in there. There really is. I would encourage individuals to read it. Lockdowns, modified operations, impact a lot of different areas for our families who listen out there. Obviously, visitation is a huge deal, but also is that access to phones and emails and knowing what's going on. We see it all the time on our Facebook page. Anyone that know what's going on at FCI, wherever? I haven't heard from my family member in 4 days. Are they locked down? If an institution suspends visiting, they do put a banner up on their public page.
The website, right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that's telling you that they've suspended.
Right.
Yes. Right. You may check it on Thursday and it's fine. And on Friday at 1:30, two or three groups of individuals decide to fight on the rec yard, and now we're locking down. So things to think about. Okay. So let's talk about the new First Step Back assessment, programming, and incentive policy statement. First off, when you look at the policy, and this is true with any policy, they've changed the banner organization on how the policies look, but they still have something called the DPI.
Right.
That is the division that's responsible, right? So I'm looking at inmate recreation. That is put out by the Reentry Services Division, because recreation is over there, right? So if you look at the First Step Back assessment, programming, and incentives policy, it says under DPI, it says DIR. It is under the director's office. So, which is a big thing, which is a big deal.
Big deal.
So, and I'm glad to see that. I am not pleased with the content of the policy, the way it's written. There's some things in there that I have issue with, but we'll get to that. I'll tell you why I have issue. But the director, putting it under the director's office. So one of the challenges when I was still working was we had multiple divisions involved in FSA. And unfortunately, as is the case with government agencies, you have stovepipes of information, right? This is here, and this is here, and this is there, and information will go out in one division. I can't tell you how many times we would get a phone call in correctional programs asking us a question, and we go, "What are you talking about?" Well, so-and-so put out in a Teams meeting to this group about this or that. And we're like, then you should call them, because we don't know anything about it. Unfortunately, they were putting out information that was relevant to programs. So, you know, as we've heard on the Bureau's website with some of the interviews and stuff, they are establishing a First Step Back branch. That branch is going to be located under the director's office. It's coming together. As far as I know, it's not been fully realized. But when that happens, the idea is all FSA functions will be coordinated under one branch with one administrator under the boss, not an AD here and an AD there. And they're kind of like beefing with each other.
Will Mr. Stover be in the loop on this deal?
My understanding is Mr. Stover is the man who is coordinating and putting this to going to be building, getting this to this branch. I don't know that it'll be a, it won't be a new division. It'll be a branch located under the director's office. Just like they moved public affairs and legislative affairs used to be under the information IPA, the old IPA division. And they are now under the director's office. So this will be another branch that's located in the director's office. And ideally, some of the things of the past will get resolved. It didn't get resolved with this one, even though the policy is officially under the director's office. This draft, this final version came out a while ago as a draft, long while ago. In fact, I started seeing stuff circulating before I retired. And I do have some serious problems with it. But one of my biggest concerns, and I say this for individuals, family members that are listening, for their loved ones, individuals that are facing prison, one of the changes, and I'm going to take my glasses off so I can see it. One of the changes is under programming. Got to find it. Here it is. On page 6. Inmates are responsible for contacting relevant departments to inform them of their interest in participating in recommended programs. Departments will review the request, follow program-specific criteria for registering inmates for desired programs. The department responsible for the program must utilize the Insight feedback application. That's the Insight is the team application that UniTeam uses that other departments can provide feedback to the team. To provide relevant explanation as to why the inmate did not meet the specific program requirements at the time of the request, the same department should suggest alternative programs to address identified criminogenic needs. So under the FSA, it says the Bureau staff will assign programming. So inmate Smith, unit team, and all the Spark 13 people say, we're going to do, we do all of our assessments, and you come up with a parenting need. I'm just going to pick on parenting. You come up with a parenting under family and parenting, and the unit team says, okay, we're going to recommend you participate in the National Parenting Program. If you, the department's with that are supposed to, with the parenting program, are supposed to be seeing those needs where it says family parenting, yes, and is supposed to be calling you over to their office to say, okay, Mr. Smith, you have this need. We have a class starting next week. We're putting you on the waiting list. No, I don't want it. I don't have any contact with my kids. I'm not taking that. You sure? Declining this program with a required need is going to put you in opt-out status. I ain't doing it. Okay. In decline. Now you're in opt-out status. Now you're not earning time credits. That's what the law says. Staff will assign. Now, UniTeam writes that recommendation. And in this policy, they're saying that now the inmate is responsible to take himself over to that department. Hey, my UniTeam recommended this. I need to sign up for this. Where's the documentation? When is that person going to be placed in op status if they don't do something? Where under the old system, there was an affirmative process where the individual was asked, are you agreeing to the program? Yes or no. Now it's, oh, they're responsible for going over. So one unit team may put on there and may be watching it. One case manager will be like, well, I told you to go see education within the next 30 days and you haven't, I'm putting you in opt-out. Another unit team may say, wait till you come back for your team in 6 months and say, hey, why haven't you signed up? Another team might not do anything because they made the recommendation, but it's education's job to enroll them. And I'm just picking on that particular class. There is no definitive timeline. There's nothing in here that says, when, if you don't go over to what department, are you going to be put into opt-out status? And I am telling you, that is going to create a problem. So for our people, I'm going to say, don't even wait for your team to tell you to do it. Just go sign up.
Just go, because there's
going to be an issue. And then, okay, so now you go the unit team because it says anger, yes. I'll pick on a different one. Okay, we're recommending anger management. So you do carry yourself over to psychology. Psychology goes, yeah, that's not the right program for you. We're thinking about this. Well, but my unit team says I got to take anger management. Well, but we make that decision. We'll tell your unit team what we think you should do. So they're supposed to go into feedback and say, hey, he doesn't meet the criteria for this. We're recommending this. What if they forget? What if right after your conversation with the psychologist, when they said they're not going to sign you up for it because you don't meet whatever, there's an alarm, there's an emergency on the yard and everybody's responding. And that notation never gets made. You, as the individual inmate, have no documentation, no proof that you did what you were supposed to do. I went over there. They told me this was the wrong class. They said they were going to talk. There's no documentation. Again, this is just, this is a problem looking for a place to happen. When I saw this in draft, I profoundly objected to it. In fact, I won't pick on the department online, but the department that pushed this particularly was trying to do this previously. And it was myself and my counterpart in correctional programs that were like, wait a minute, this says staff has to assign. And their argument was, well, but what if it's not the right program? So instead of waiting for the unit team, can an individual department say, no, we're not going to put you in this class, we're going to put you in this class? And our response was, yeah, that's fine, as long as he's put on a list and he's agreeing to participate. Right. I see this completely falling through the cracks. I think this is going to be a hot mess, and it's going to further cause issues with OIG and GAO. And we'll talk about that next. If we get to
I think you're right. You know, I also hope and pray, and it's seemingly many inmates would be very interested about, from, you know, they hear from their peers on the yard or housing units, but they'd be like, hey, how do I get my FSA? Hey, you know, who do I need to talk to? Hey, Mr. and Miss Case Manager. I think a lot of inmates are going to take a proactive approach.
My recommendation is do everything by email. Yeah. Everything by email. Send that email over to psychology. My unit team recommended I take anger management and drug education. Yeah. I'd like to sign up now. And then if something falls through the crack, and it will, I'm telling you, it will, they're human beings. At least the individual inmate has the documentation of, here's the email. I did what you told me to do. I did not opt out. And that is my best advice. This is a bad idea. We are going to run out of time. It is already 4:44,
six minutes,
and change. Some other things that I saw as problematic in here is, and I'm trying to scan it really fast. The ones, what right before I retired, I had actually made the suggestion because, and this was long before the whole idea of having a branch under the director's office was born, right?
Right?
I, as a programs person, was seeing these different divisions were doing different things. Back then, they were also looking at moving psychology out of the reentry division and over to health services as kind of a behavioral health component. So then we were going to have a third division involved. So we'd have, you know, we had correctional programs, we had reentry services, we were looking at having medical. We still have medical involved because medical is one of the areas. And as we talked about earlier in the show, the rec leisure fitness relies on the fitness component, which is medical. And then you have, as part of RSD, you also have the whole halfway house and home confinement. They're under reentry. And so you had all these different kind of competing interests and who's responsible for what. And then when you step aside from those kind of direct dealing with the inmate population, then you have folks like, wait for it, the computer services folks that do they're doing the programming and things like that. And how do issues get reported? I would have things happen, and I was very close with the programmer, the main programmer. He and I worked together a lot. There were many nights where we were on Teams meetings to 7-8 o'clock at night, kind of going through testing the application and making sure it was working or finding debugging things and things. But invariably I would get a message from him saying, oh, so-and-so in this division wants to change this and it's going to impact the time credits, but I wasn't. And I'm just like, whoa, don't stop. Do that. Yeah. Wait a minute. So my thought was we needed a program statement, literally labeled the First Step Act program, that addressed the who's responsible for what, kind of be a rules of the road policy statement. And it can refer to the time credit policy, and it can refer to the incentive policy, and it can refer to the assessment policy, but it would lay out the process, right? When changes need to happen, where do they go to? When there's issues, who do you talk to? That's what I envisioned. And I even one night kind of penned out the skeleton of a program statement. Well, egos were involved, and we won't go there, but the result was this Frankenstein policy that I will call, where we just kind of mashed a whole bunch of stuff together. Time credits is still a separate policy. There's even some, and I was trying to find it. There is in here a definition. I believe it's under the incentive section. Oh, here it is. Wait a minute. I found it. Don't I have like 1 minute to talk? Defining successful participation. In general, successful participation in a program, an inmate must attend all sessions with only excused absences, complete all assignments, assigned activities and work, comply with all program rules and instructions set forth by the program manager or facilitator. Successful participation may lead to earning various incentives. Please refer to the FSA pages on the Bureau's public and intranet sites for specific criteria. FTC eligibility, earning, and application criteria are found in, and they refer to the program statement. So essentially, you can be successfully participating for the sake of time credits, but for the sake of incentives, you're not successfully participating because we don't have the same definitions. I have a problem with that as well. But we don't have time to be on my soapbox too long because we're at the end of the show already. So we've got one more thing to talk about. We'll put that on the docket for next time, unless the Bureau drops a whole bunch of new policies. But, for those out there, tell your loved ones, all programming recommendations, emails to the applicable department head, and then keep that email as your documentation that you went and said you were going to participate. Cause there are people who are going to get put in opt-out status. Yeah. Because this is a mess.
Keep that paper trail.
Keep the paper trail. Okay. So, well, end of the show.
Exciting episode. Yeah, yeah. And remember to get our books.
All three of them.
For pre-trial. All three of them now. The three book series.
The newest one, Understanding Halfway, Unlocking Halfway House and Home Confinement under the Second Chance Act. It's the red book. And it's our newest one. It has a ton of information. Explains all the ins and outs of halfway house, of reentry needs, of the five-factor review, of how to talk about your release needs when you're talking to your unit team, and even the timelines and what can mess up your timeline and things to be prepared as it's your life.
Remember, take control of it. If you're not FSA eligible, you probably need to read about the SCA.
Absolutely. We also, though, cover the FSA-SCA stacking. We have a whole chapter on what is stacking and how does it work. So I think that's it for today.
That's it for today. So, yep, come by our Facebook group and YouTube channel, First Step Act. And otherwise, we look forward to seeing everybody here next week on Around the Block here on LA Talk Radio. So take care, everybody. Be good. See you next
Bye-bye.
Time.
Take care. Bye-bye. Yep.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.